So, tell me about Ruth Hawk. What do you remember about Ruth Hawk?
Well, I just loved Ruth Hawk. She and I would meet before the meetings and have dinner together. And we would always have cocktails. And I can remember very well that we each had 3 whiskey sours before we go to the meeting. It always worried me for fear this would bother some of the men there. But far from it. They loved it. They said, oh, if we could only drink like that. And they always kidded us about it and enjoyed the fact that we had a good time over our dinner. And Ruth was a wonderful person in every way. In those days of the very early AA, there had to be lots of letters written to people from all over everywhere that wrote in to ask questions about AA. And Ruth was one that very often had to either write the letters or sort of help other people to write them. And she just wrote some wonderful letters to the people that wrote in. And she was a very excellent secretary, and she was a warm, a wonderful person, and she was a very pretty girl. She had dimples when she laughed, and she laughed most of the time, and she had a laugh that was so infectious that anybody that heard her laugh wanted to laugh too. And I always have great happy memories of every minute that I spent with Ruth.
How about Morgan Ryan?
Morgan Ryan, the handsome. He was one of the most handsome men that I ever saw. But he wasn't only handsome. He had a very dynamic personality. He had a sort of a typical Irish type of handsomeness, in that he had very black curly hair and very blue eyes and this dynamic personality, very thoughtful, sincere person that, with a very special way of expressing his thoughts about AA. He was a very convincing person when he talked in AA. I remember Morgan particularly saying that he had absolutely no hope, absolutely no hope before he came to AA. And that in talking to a nun at one point about his hopelessness in his drinking, she told him that when a person was really down to the place where they had absolutely no hope, that then there was hope for them. And he often thought of that because of finding AA just after he had had this talk with her. And so he often mentioned that when, in his talks. You could always hear a pin drop when Morgan Ryan talked. Even the men were so impressed. There was just no doubt about it as far as the women were concerned. We had a few other handsome men. Bert Taylor was pretty handsome. Bert had been married, and I think he was then separated from his wife. But we did have quite a few men that were completely separated from their wives, who were very personable. Very intelligent. Do you know the old saying about alcoholics are a little more intelligent than the rest of the people? I always believed it firmly because of my early experience in AA. They were certainly the most wonderfully intelligent men. Ray Campbell, who wrote the last chapter of the big book called An Artist's Concept, was a special friend of mine because, in a way, he was handsome, not in the same way that Morgan Ryan was, but Ray was a handsome man. He was very depressed because he was separated from his wife this time, but he was a super intelligent person, and he had done a picture of the head of Christ, which was just so fascinating. I can't tell you that was a very famous thing in the early AA days, because people would say, did you see that picture that Ray did? And if there was anybody that hadn't seen that, we thought they weren't educated yet, you know. They just had to see that. That was one of the great musts in early AA. And when I finally did, when Bill did ask me, you see, I don't know just how the sequence is here, but when Bill asked me if I would get Marty Mann and bring her over to the house, then Ray Campbell figured in this very definitely, because I was appalled at trying to deal with Marty myself. She and I had one trait in common in those days, that neither one of us liked women very well. And she definitely didn't like women. And she didn't like me. And I didn't like her. So I thought, ye gods, what am I going to do with this woman around the house? When I went to pick her up in the sanitarium, she was pacing the floor in her bare feet, and she had a slip on, and that was all. Pacing the floor. And over in the corner of this room that she was pacing in this fancy sanitarium, was a pile of unopened letters. And I said to her, what are all those letters? And she said, oh, she didn't want to bother with them. She never opened them for 2 years. At least that's what she said, that they had accumulated for 2 years. I could believe it. She didn't know what to wear to go to my house. She didn't know what to do. So it boiled down to the fact that some woman came in and helped me throw a few clothes in a suitcase for her. And I actually sat her down and put some slacks on her, which she wouldn't do for herself. And I had my four-year-old daughter with me, Carol, to drive home, and I thought, I really was worried. I thought, this woman is so much more a coupe than I expected to have, and whatever are we going to do with her when we get her home? This crazy, you know, if I'm going to have to dress her. I was terrified, really, all the way home, and it was quite a long drive. So when I got Marty home, I just didn't know what to do with her, and I sat her down and got her some coffee and just felt in absolute despair as to what to do now. When my husband came home, and he came home early that night, she took one look at him and everything was all right. You never thought she'd had a thing wrong with her. She knew exactly how to act when a man was around, and he liked her immediately. So everything was fine. He took over that evening, and so all went well. We had a nice evening, with he and Marty talking like old buddy-buddies, so I had a chance to get the child to bed and, you know, do the things I had to do, get the dinner and the dishes. And so, meanwhile, I've been thinking. Myron couldn't, of course, talk to her about AA because he was still drinking. That had been my only worry, for fear I'd get her drinking. But he had better sense than that. So he didn't drink that evening. But I'd been thinking about Ray Campbell. I thought, now there's the person for Marty to get her AA from, because he could really dish it out and He was so handsome, and so I called Ray that night and told him that I had this crazy girl and that Bill wanted me to keep her in our house for at least a week, and that I was very perturbed about having her for this week. I said, she's all right now because my husband's with her and she's all right with men. And I said, I would like to bring her up to your place, Ray, and have you take over tomorrow. And he said, that's fine. Get her up here as early as you can. He said, you think you can be up here by 10 o'clock? He lived up in Carmel, New York, and he had a house up there on Gypsy Lake. I said, yes, I can have her there by 10. As soon as the children leave for school, I'll be ready and we'll take off and come right up. That was about a 60-mile drive. And Marty was rather quiet on that drive up there. She didn't know what I was going to do with her, and it had her kind of worried. And I just kept telling her, I'm taking you to a very handsome man, so relax. And she thought maybe I was kidding her, you know. But however, when she saw Ray's house, saw Ray, saw this lake and this pretty place, she was very willing. So I had a copy of the Sermon on the Mount, which we used a lot in early AA. I offered it to Ray. I think he said, I've got a copy of it. Anyway, he had a copy. Whether he took my copy and used it or not, I don't know. But he told me, he said, you do whatever you feel like, and I'll talk to Marty. So after just having a cup of coffee and talking a little bit, I took off and left the two of them alone. And he said to me, is this tape on? Well, he later said to me that Marty took the bait, hook, line, and sinker, and just was completely convinced right from the first, and that she was very thrilled and excited about it, and that he didn't think I'd have any more trouble with her, or that she was a different person than the one that I had brought then. So I was real thrilled to hear that, and so Marty and I were able to talk a lot about all that she and Ray had talked about and on the way home, and we really had a very pleasant week then, from then on. Now later, some years later, having not seen Marty after the first couple of years that she was in AA, then I didn't see her for a while. I don't know just why. She was someplace else and I was someplace else. But then I suddenly met her, we'll say after maybe we'd both been in around 4 or 5 years, and I asked her if she remembered my coming to the sanitarium and getting her and taking her up to Ray Campbell's place. And she said, you know, I hardly remember it at all. She said, it's so hazy in my mind. She said, I used to wonder whether I had really dreamed it up or whether it had really happened. And she said, no, that she was sorry, but that she just really could hardly remember it at all. And so that was the sort of story. No, the last time that I saw her was at Long Beach Convention. What year was that? 60? Mm-hmm. She was one of the midnight speakers or something on one of those marathon talking things. And it was after that that we talked together about this.
How about Jim Burwell?
Well, I had known Jimmy Burwell from the first night that he signed my book. He was one of the ones that was there that night the book was sold. So I had known Jimmy, and Jimmy fairly well, and Rosa slightly. I just didn't want to say that.
So you didn't have too much contact with Jim Burwell in those days. How about Cookie Wall?
Oh, I saw Cookie all the time, but he was never one of my real well-known ones.
Wilbur Smith?
Oh, yes, I knew Burr Smith and his wife, Ruth. I know, I saw them a lot. Burr was one of the first alcoholic members to serve on the board. You know, they set up this board that Leonard Strong served on to start with, and Burr served on that as the first alcoholic to serve on the board, which was quite an honor.
Horace Crystal?
Oh yes, I knew Horace well, liked Horace very much. He was one of the first ones. I believe he was there the first night that I went to Bill's house, that rainy night that I was first there. Horace was one of the ones that was there. Always a very interesting person, a very interesting speaker, and always a good friend.
How about Fritz Mayo?
Yes, I met Fritz. He came up from Washington. One of the nights that I was at Bill, we had a few women the night that he came, and I believe Florence Rankin came up with him from Washington. She was the first woman alcoholic in AA, and I believe that was the first time I met her, that she and Fitz came up together. Fitz had a southern accent that you could cut with a knife, but he was the most typical southern gentleman I had ever met or ever hoped to meet. He was good-looking and sort of a ladies' man, and a very definite personality. He had very definite beliefs and disbeliefs, and although he was very firm about them, he also was, very thoughtful of other people's beliefs, too. A lot of fun to know. His full name was Fitzhugh. We always just called him Fitz. And yes, he was really real wonderful to meet.
How about Bill Rudell?
Rudell. Yes, I met Bill Rudell and saw him quite a bit. But there again, I was never as close to Bill as to many of the others.
There's one other one I would like to. It's Hank Parkhurst.
Well, of course, Hank Parkhurst, I knew right from the first meeting. He was the first meeting that I went to in Bill's house. And he later married my sister Carolyn. So I did get to know Hank pretty well. In the early days of AA, Hank was a very important person because he helped to express the things that Bill and the others wanted to express. They would sort of feed to Hank, and Hank would put them in phrases that were acceptable to everybody and that were very well put. I can recall these Sundays that we went to somebody's house in New Jersey where they were trying to write the chapters of the big book, and Hank was at a typewriter, and he was a good typist, and he was also a deep thinker. He spoke with a hesitation in his voice because he had been a very sick man before he came to AA and had left him with some kind of a peculiar, I don't want to say stoppage in his speech, but he did have a peculiar way of speaking. And sometimes when they would give him a few things they wanted to say, I can see him sitting there. He had a pencil on his ear because he was scratching out things all the time and erasing things. And then he would say how he was going to say this. He might write it down first. Then he would type it. Then he would read it. Then they'd all think about it. And they'd all pick at the pieces. So he might have to write it two or three times. This went on quite a few Sundays that I remember. I think Ruth Hawk must have taken me. I really don't know how I got there, because they were in New Jersey. And Hornell asked about Dr. Howard. He was one of the ones that came there and expressed opinions.
How about Hank? What did he contribute to the office structure? Did he help set up the procedures there?
Yes. He helped in many ways. He was married to Kathleen Parkhurst at this time. And Kathleen, at that time, was very interested in a man named Wally, who came to AA, to the early meetings. And Hank, like all the rest of men, was very interested in Ruth Hawk, because Ruth was so cute, so attractive, and really so lovable. Everybody loved Ruth. And Hank was no different from the others in that respect, except that because of Ruth being the secretary, he probably had to see her more than the others when he was trying to get all this going. Hank was a very hard man to oppose. If he had an idea that he wanted to express, he got really very annoyed if they just wouldn't have that idea. So this led to quite a lot of controversy, which eventually became serious. And eventually Hank had to bow out, or else somebody else did. Now, because of time situation, I don't know just when that occurred. But of course, it did occur. It had to.
So tell me now, tell me something about you and Myron, and how, you know, over the years, and from the beginning, you know, sort of when Myron came and up to now, just in general, that's all. Just think back, that's all.
Mm-hmm. Well, my husband, Myron, as I have said previously, was an alcoholic from his first drink. He had an awful personality change when he drank. He was a wonderful man when he was not drinking. And he was not so wonderful when he drank. In fact, sometimes if he drank dry martini, which he loved, he really became a very different person entirely. Which always was such a shock to me. I drank drink for drink with my husband. Whenever we went out anywhere together, we always sat at bars because we never drank at home. So I became a bar drinker along with my husband Myron. The only difference was I had to be the one to drive home because he was always under the table or sick or really just so drunk that he couldn't drive. This went on for years. He had a job. It was the same company all these years, and this job of his, he thought, required a great deal of drinking. He had to entertain these advertising men, and in order to get their contracts, he drank with them. And we went to conventions, many conventions, through the year. We left our children with his mother and father, and I went with him. I always hoped to keep him from getting just so terribly drunk. that he would ruin a lot of his business connections because of it. And I would try so hard to straighten him out because I had seen the whole thing and had been with him through it all. But his drinking progressed and got worse as the years went on. I drank more and more as the years went on, but I never got sick. He could stop drinking for 2 or 3 weeks or a month if he felt like it, if he got sick enough to really want to. This I could not do. When he stopped drinking, we went on living just exactly the same as if he were drinking because we had to go to the bars to get my drinks by this time. And he liked this because he liked the life even if he weren't drinking. If he were drinking coffee while I was having drinks, we were at the same bars as when he was drinking. So all this time, of course, though, that I was doing all this drinking, all my best friends were in AA. Bill and all my friends away from Myron were all in AA. They didn't think it was anything at all for me to drink because I was a normal drinker, they thought. So, as the time went on and I still hounded Bill and everybody else in AA, I went up to High Watch all the time. I would take girls who were sick and awful and drunk. Somebody would call me and say, "Will you take this one up to High Watch because she's just no good the way she is, and if she has a couple weeks up there, maybe we can get her to some meeting, get her sobered up." And High Watch would take these people and sober them up. They had a doctor came. So I just was always driving somebody up to High Watch. And every time I'd get up there, I was just crazy about Wes Irvine and his wife, Kay. Wes was the alcoholic and Kay was not. So I would say to Wes, "But Wes, how can I get my husband Myron to come up here?" I said, "I try and try. I try to get him to go to a meeting. He won't. What can we do? What can get him into AA?" And Wes would say, "You just have to be patient. You have to wait till he's ready. The more you talk about it, the more you'll drive him the other way, etc."
Okay, let me change the tape.
Okay. It's on or off?
It's on now.
I think you've probably heard of High Watch Farm. High Watch Farm was a very wonderful place, about 395 acres in Connecticut. It's run by a woman named Sister Frances.
What if they put that on paper?
Well, now wait, don't yet. No. Oh. A very unusual person. She traveled all over the world, and she liked to help people that needed help. That was the reason she was calling herself Frances. And when Bill first met her, he had a lot of strays living at her house, and some were women and some were men, and some of the men were alcoholics. So he was telling her about our few that were staying sober in AA, and she got so interested, and she wanted him to bring them up, you know, so that she could meet some of them. And that was just the way it started years ago, before the book was written. So I have a time that we went up there that I won't tell about when on the tape, involved a rather unusual turn of events. But just for Dorothy's sake, I just wanted to say that then eventually Sister Frances turned his property over to AA, and she moved into the city, and some of the AA members took over the running of High Watch and sent people that needed to be dried out. They were sent there, and they had a doctor that came every morning, and he gave these people the medical treatment that they needed, while AA gave them the spiritual, and the physical was pretty well taken care of by the wonderful food that they served and the just gorgeous part of the Connecticut that was there. It was just such a beautiful place.
And Sister Frances' little house was about 300 years old, and it was filled with the most beautiful art treasures. She brought them all over the world. And when we had the, well, when A.A. had finally taken it over, of course, they took a lot of these things out so that they wouldn't be broken, and she took them with her and so on. But it was always a place with a certain kind of flavor, a kind of peacefulness about it that she had set from her living there, mm-hmm. that no matter how many drunks they got to high watch, it never changed that atmosphere. It's a marvelous place to go. So, all right, now where were we? Well, I never could get him to go. But finally, we did get him to a meeting down at the 24th Street Clubhouse. So you see that a lot of time had passed. I would think maybe, I don't know, how many years AA had been in existence then. But when the night that we finally got him to go to that meeting, he was so horrible, he was so arrogant, and he was so furious at me and for anybody else that wanted him to go there. And he almost disrupted the meeting, so we gave up again on mine for a while. But the thing was that we were always searching for ways, and this was before AA had high watch, or before I'd ever been up there. Bill called me one day and said that he and Lois had just thought of a wonderful way to get mine to AA. Since we had tried other things and never worked, so I said, fine, what was it? He said, we're going to invite you and Myron to be our guests up at High Watch over the Memorial Day weekend. And I said, well, it's a wonderful idea, Bill, but he won't come. He said, oh, yes, he will. He said, I just know he will. I said, all right, I'll do my best. I said, I certainly wish he'd come. He said, well, he was going to say some prayers about it. Lois was going to say some prayers about it. And I said, I'm going to say some prayers about it. I just had a feeling he wouldn't go. But I said, Bill, regardless of whether Myron comes or not, I'm going to go. I want to go. So he said, all right. He said, just let me know as soon as you can whether he's going to come. So after I asked Myron if he would go, and I made it sound so enticing to go up to this beautiful place and have a nice weekend, and he just absolutely froze and said, that bunch of jerks again, that wish they'd let you alone, let me alone. And so I didn't say any more, and then I called Bill when I got a chance and said that I didn't think Myron was going to come, but when he and Lois came, our street was a dead-end street, and to be sure to turn around first and drive past our house up to the next house and just wait there. And I said, don't blow the horn or anything, because I'm going to come and I may have to sneak out. Well, he didn't know whether he approved of that or not. He kind of kidded me and was kind of half serious, so I just packed a little overnight bag and I hid it in a little place near the front door. And Myron's mother and father were going to be there to be with the children, so that was no problem. So that morning, while Myron was in a good mood and hadn't had a drink yet, I asked him once more if he wouldn't please go. And that I knew we'd have a wonderful time. And he just absolutely wouldn't, and he absolutely forbade me to have anything more to do with that bunch of drugs. Just forget it. So I watched Pavel and Lois to go turn around in front. And then when I saw that they were turned and in front of the other house, I waited my moment. And I ran out the house, and I snatched up my little bag, and I ran, got in the car, and I said, take off, take off, take off, because I knew he'd come after me. Sure enough, he came running out and calling for me to get out of that car, and Kabil drove on up the hill. But he was laughing, and he said, he really does make things tough for you, doesn't he? So I went to High Watch with Bill Miller. That was the first time that we ever had a meeting at High Watch. And the first time that most people had ever even seen it, and it was very early in AA. A few women went. Ruth Hawk, I know, was one, and Lois was one, and there were several others. Jean Williams went. Just, I knew all these girls. There were five or six of them, and the rest were men. And I'd say that there might have been 15 or 20 people altogether. And that was the most wonderful weekend of my life. It was such a wonderful experience that it just almost defies description. Aside from it being such perfect weather, it was just so beautiful in the early part of May. And the place itself is so beautiful. And that little house had such a peaceful feeling to it, and so many beautiful things in it. And we all had such a good time right from the time that we first got there. We all just were so glad to be together, to all these people that had just gotten sober and all just loving us so much, you know, and being so glad to have this opportunity to just relax and be together and have some fun. So somebody proposed that we all jump in some cars and go down to the lake for a swim. Well, it had gotten quite hot, but it was still pretty early for swimming. But that didn't matter. We all dug up something to swim in, which was a riot. If you'd ever seen what I got. And we went in these various cars down to the lake, and the lake was very cold, just icy. But we all just had a marvelous time, and then we came back and had dinner, and all just so happy all the time, and so much inspiration all the time for the AA way of life. And then somebody said, why don't we all go over to that dance over so-and-so dance hall? Well, right away. Everybody was all for that, to go driving over to this dance somewhere. Well, I didn't feel too much like doing that because I felt pretty much alone by this time. After all these handsome men all had the girls that were there, and, you know, the girls that weren't married, like Ruth and some of the others. And I, being the married one that was alone, felt kind of self-conscious. So I thought maybe I shouldn't go to the dance. And then Ray Campbell was there, and Ray was so depressed over his separation from his wife. And so somebody said, well, why don't you and Ray both come together, because you're both sort of loners at this point. So Ray said, well, he would if I would. So I said, all right. So we went as a team to this dance. Well, we just had such fun. We got Ray out of his doldrums, got me out of mine, and so then we danced till the very last, till they closed the place, and just had a marvelous time. And then we came home, and oh, we had such a wonderful time. Before we went to bed, we had a kind of a little meeting get-together, some coffee, and talking about the day, and everything, you know, how I ate, but I hate to go to bed. But the next morning, Sunday morning, when we woke up, it was just another just gorgeous spring morning. Oh, the place was so beautiful. And there was this wonderful, peaceful feeling, just, oh, just unimaginable. It didn't seem to me I had ever felt this kind of wonderful, peaceful feeling before. Like you could just touch it. It seemed to be a something. And all the other people seemed to feel the same way. So we had our breakfast, and then we all were kind of in the front room together because Bill had said the night before he and Lois were going to stay up in the little cottage on the hill. And he had said that we would have a meeting. I don't know, I think he said 10 o'clock. So we were all there in this front room of Sister Francis' little house. And it was getting around 10, about 20 of 10. We were all kind of talking and waiting for Bill and Lois to come. And I was standing by the window looking out toward the cottage. And I saw them coming. There was a winding path that came down. It would come through a little wooded area, and then it would come out in a little open place. And there were weeds that were kind of hip high. And then they would come to a place where there was just grass, and then through the woods some more. So I was watching them coming, and I just had this strange feeling that I had never had in my life before. And it seemed to me that everybody around me must have somewhat the same feeling, because they all seemed to. And so then I said, as they got quite close, I said, "They're coming." So everybody crowded around the window for a few minutes and watched them come. Then they all took seats. You could have heard a pin drop. There wasn't a sound in that room. So Bill and Lois came to the door, and they looked so surprised to see us all sitting there so quiet. And Bill smiled that little quiet smile of his. And he said, "Are you all right? Can we say good morning?" And we all laughed, of course, but the stillness came right back. Just a hushed feeling. And so then Lois sat down, and Bill stood in front of us. And he looked so wonderful. He looked the best I'd seen that morning. He was still thin, and he was still pretty white, but he just looked more relaxed and happy than I had seen him. And he stood there not looking at us, and then he bowed his head and stood with his head bowed for a while. Then he just started the meeting. All these years since, I certainly wish that I had a tape recording of that meeting, because I could never quote what Bill said, and yet I could quote that there was like magic. I tried to tell Nell Wing a kind of electricity, a kind of something that you never feel anywhere else in your life. It was just sort of a once-in-a-lifetime experience. So, it was a wonderful day that day, too. I left the others and went with Sister Frances. She showed me a lot of things. She told me about her very wonderful life and her travels in Europe and all over the world. And then it was time to go start home. So, as soon as I got in the car to start home, I began to have this awful feeling. I've got to face that husband of mine when I get home. And I said to Bill, "Bill, I really am scared." And he said, "Don't worry about it. I'm going to go in with you when I get home and give me a chance to talk to my aunt." I said, "Oh, Bill, don't do that. Please don't do that." I said, "You don't know what he'll do to you." Well, he laughed. He said, "What do you mean what he'll do to me?" And I said, "He's a very violent man when he gets angry, and he gets very angry about this AA thing. And he'll be very angry that I didn't listen to his command not to go, but went." And I said, "I don't care really what he does to me. I really don't. But I wouldn't want him to do anything to you." Bill said, "Nonsense." Well, Lois tried to talk to him, too. She said, "Well, Bill, maybe you'd be better off to listen to what Virginia said about me." He would have none of it. He said he'd been waiting all these years for a chance to talk to Myron. He's going to talk to Myron. So When we got to the house,
Laura stayed in the car, and Bill and I went in. Ann Myron was just like an angry bull. He was so furious. And he was so angry. It was the first time he had seen Bill, first time he met him. He ordered him out of the house and wanted to know what he was doing, ruining his wife and all this. He called him all kinds of names. And Bill kind of took it all and sort of, in his stride, until all of a sudden, Byron turned and really hit him, hit his heart. Oh, don't knock Bill down. Well, that really took the wind out of Bill's sails. But although I think he still would have tried to talk to Myron, I just pleaded with him, Bill, please go. And Myron ordered him out of the house until he never came back. Right. So Bill finally left. So when Myron did eventually come into AA, he had the very dubious distinction of being the only member of AA who had ever shown funky trouble. And Bill never let him forget it. Whenever we were, alone, where it could hit him or whenever, Myron tried to, Bill enjoyed throwing that up to him, and so did I. So when Myron finally came to the place that he thought he would like to see what AA was all about and maybe try it, he said he was now willing to let me take him up to Bill, and he would talk to Bill about coming into AA. So I called Bill on the QT and told him this, asked when to bring Myron, and Bill said tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, having here tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. And so that morning, I drove Myron up to Bill Wilson's house in Bedford Hills, and Bill met us with a pleasant smile and handshake for Myron, and I told him to just go right on in the house. And he introduced him to Lois, and he introduced him to Howard Wilson. And then he said, now, you and Howard are going to have lots to talk about, so Lois and Jimmy and I are going to go out and have a little visit outside for a while, and we'll see you later. Well, Myron, so crestfallen, he'd always been one to go to the head man in any outfit, and he had just expected that Bill himself would get him sober, And I thought it was so cute of Bill that he had set himself with Howard Wilson to do the talking. And so Bill North and I went out, went for a walk, and we just stayed out really for hours, and we just had such a good time. When we went back, Myron had been long since ready to go home and didn't know where to find us, So anyway, that was Myron's introduction to AA, and he did start going to meetings then. And I was very delighted. And I went to meetings with him, but as a wife, because, of course, I was still drinking. Seems ridiculous, doesn't it? Well,
I think it's wonderful.
So Myron went to AA meetings all the time, and I went with him, as good wives are supposed to do. But we still lived our old life. We would go out to dinner to the bars where we had been going for years drinking. I would have my drinks while Myron had coffee or ginger ale. And that went on for 9 months, in which time he had 9 months sobriety. And I thought those were just the most wonderful 9 months I had ever known, because he really was a different person during those 9 months. So then, one night, while we were in our favorite bar eating dinner, I had had my drink, and I was having my beer with my meal. Well, I never liked beer with meal, so he never had had beer with his meal. I always did. and I was told him that was the reason he got sick, and I didn't, because the beer kept me from getting sick. Well, the waiter went by with a little tray up on one hand. It had three dry martinis on it. And as it went by mine, he just lifted one off and gulped it down. That was the end of his 9 months of sobriety and the beginning of some awful, awful time. And it's because he is hitting so much harder than when he's been drinking better that we really had an awful life then. So I began to say to anybody that would listen to me that if he would ever stop again, I would stop too, because I felt that I'd been responsible for him taking that drink. And a lot of other people felt that way too. His sponsors certainly felt that way. And so I said this to all my drinking pals and anybody else that would listen, that if he would ever go back into AA, I would quit drinking too. I didn't say I'd go to AA as a member, because I never, ever thought that I was an alcoholic and I was saved. So we had such rough times, and his business suffered terribly. He got along just fine while he was sober in his business, but when he got drunk again, it was terrible. So his boss came to see me, the president of his company, and say, how could we go about getting back into AA? That they just felt they couldn't take him around the office any longer. He was so bad. So eventually, we got him back into AA. So guess what? I had been saying all this time that I would quit drinking when he did. And I had really thought that I could if I put my mind to it. I sure got the shock of my life, because it was so hard for me to stop that I couldn't believe it. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't talk to anybody, because it seemed like my vocal cords had just been turned off. My personality had been turned off. I was just miserable, and I hated everyone. I just hated him with a deep, dark, purple passion, because he was the reason I had to stop drinking. And I really just hated everything and everybody. But I did stay sober by sheer willpower and gritting my teeth and just hanging on through just miserable. I just couldn't imagine living that way. I couldn't imagine the rest of my life without drinking. Well, of course, he did a lot of I told you so to me, you know, and everything. And so finally, he went away on a 2-week trip, and I was going to go horseback riding with one of my drinking pals, and it really never occurred to me. I hadn't planned any slip. You hear people say they planned to take a drink. I thought I'd just gotten sober and I was going to stay that way or else. But when I went for a ride with this girl, it was cold, started rainy morning, and we really did get chilled when we came back from our ride. She handed me a little jigger of brandy, and she said, this will warm you up. And I never gave it one thought. I tossed that down. I said, boy, does it ever. And I said, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Well, it's true, I shouldn't have, because that really hit me so hard. And I really had to start drinking after that. Oh, I thought I'll be stopped before he's home in 2 weeks. So those 2 weeks, I just have a different experience entirely, because I had never had liquor hit me the way it did those 2 weeks after being sober for 3 months. So I could see the progressiveness of the disease, and I began to think that I'd probably long ago crossed that line that people talked about a lot, that invisible line. So during the 2 weeks before he came home, I drove up to High Watch alone, and I said to Wes and Kay, I said, I want to talk to you. And alone. And so they sat down. What's on your mind? And I said, well, such a strange thing has happened to me. You know, I said, I felt that I just have to stop fishing because of what happened to Myron. And I said, I found it terribly hard, and I finally made it for 3 months, and then all of a sudden this girl puts a glass of brandy in my hand, and I just drink it without ever a thought. Well, they laughed, and I said, but the funny part of it was, I said, that hit me so hard and made me so thirsty that I just couldn't stop drinking, and I thought, well, I've got to be sober before Myron gets home in that 2 weeks. And I said, so I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And Wes's eyes twinkled. You know, he said, did you ever stop to think what anybody else did that found they couldn't stop drinking when they wanted to? And he said, one of our definitions of an alcoholic is that they can't stop drinking when they want to, and they can't stop drinking no matter whether they're scared or whatever else. They can't stop drinking. You ever stop to think that that's one of the definitions of an alcoholic? I said, but Wes, you know I'm not an alcoholic. He said, do I? He said, what ever gave you that idea? Well, that was the first person that really, you know,